Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press.
In a federal context, there's very little protections afforded to journalists, and none of them are enforceable, so the whole thing becomes quite vague and indeterminable very quickly.
A free press means a free people.
So journalists should be able to write anything they want.
I mean, I knew that I could likely go to jail. I didn't anticipate that I'd ever spend over 200 days locked up.
Should the duty to inform be limited by the duty not to betray national security?
Not to injure the innocent? Not to corrupt the jury pool?
The debate about ethics in journalism.
When Philosophy Talk continues
after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Our topic today is ethics in journalism. We're going to dig into a couple different questions here, John. First question is, what are journalists and why are there any of them? That is, what do they do for us? And then we'll dig into some of the ethical quandaries that journalists faced and look at some of the ways they solve them or fail to solve them.
Well, Ken, I think most of these quandaries come up in kind of a familiar structure. You've got people with a certain professional set of duties, a mission. They have zeal for it. The public has a right to know and they have a right to inform. And yet, those actions are actions like any other actions with consequences, and we're all morally responsible at least for some of the consequences of our actions. Take this Virginia Tech case. The guy sends tape to NBC. NBC puts him on the air. Public's right to know, journalist's duty to inform. But then it's criticized. Well, there might be copycat serial killers who say to themselves, wow, I can be posthumously famous if I send my tapes to ABC. Was that really a good decision ethically?
Well, you raise a really important question, and I understand the worry that you have, but I'm not quite sure I see the dilemma exactly for the journalist. I mean, sometimes the journalist doing his or her duty, right, can have bad social consequences. That is, they're copycat killers. But what's the journalist supposed to do about that? I mean, maybe somebody else should regulate the journalist. Maybe the journalist should restrain him or herself. I'm not quite sure I understand where you see the dilemma.
Well, I see the dilemma as a personal dilemma for the journalist that any of us might have. I certainly don't want to see journalism regulated. But don't they have some duty to take account of the consequences of their act? In America, the press typically publishes many details about crimes or alleged crimes. Take the case of Nancy Grace and the Duke lacrosse player. She had them convicted on cable news, and yet, in the end, there was no case, and they were let off. Does the right to spill out to the public every little detail or alleged detail provided by prosecutors and police really trump the right to a fair trial?
No, I agree with you about that. That's a good question, and I'm not quite sure how to answer it. But, you know, there are all kinds of issues like that arise for journalism. A number of reporters, for example, have recently failed to divulge the sources of their stories, even when they were challenged in court or brought into court. I mean, journalists sometimes refuse to turn over their notes to police, for example, even when the police say, and maybe say rightly, that they need these notes in order to apprehend the guilty and prevent further crime. And these are hard cases. I grant you that.
You know, our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, talked to a journalist who spent more than 200 days in jail on such a matter of principle. She files this report.
Josh Wolfe has become the poster child in the debate over how we define journalism and what legal protections journalists should receive. After being out of prison less than a month, the 24-year-old blogger is feeling a little overwhelmed.
I just go onto my website and see a ton of negative comments and go like, oh, God, I don't really like this burden that's been thrust upon me.
Wolf was imprisoned after refusing to comply with a federal subpoena regarding a videotape he'd recorded of a June 2005 anti-G8 protest in which a San Francisco police officer was injured.
The demand put forth to me in January was that I testify in front of a federal grand jury, which is a secret government body, as well as provide my unedited video, the computer that I used to edit the thing, the original software. Pretty much, I'd have to turn my house over to the FBI. I mean, not quite, but it was a pretty broad demand.
Wolf refused and was held in contempt of court. He says at the time, the decision was easy.
I mean, I knew that I could likely go to jail. I didn't anticipate that I'd ever spend over 200 days locked up.
After 7.5 months behind bars, longer than any other member of the media, Wolf reached an agreement with the U.S. attorney. He would release the videotape without having to testify before a grand jury. Wolf says there's nothing of legal importance in his outtakes.
And so every night I'm going to bed in a jail thinking about the fact that I'm protecting a shot of my shoes or shaky camera or anything that there was nothing of consequence, anything that was at all incriminating. I already published that the night that it happened. The way I see it is that the tape was a battle that needed to be fought, a legal battle, which was lost.
Wolf was more concerned about the request to testify before a grand jury. He says if he had agreed to testify, he might have been asked to reveal the names of the protesters he caught on tape.
In specific, we're talking about these demonstrators, but in terms of my career, I'm not sure that it wouldn't have an effect later on. Anytime a journalist goes into a secret government hearing, that there is no public record of what they said, it's difficult to trust that person at that point forward.
Wolf says the journalists who have testified about their confidential sources in the trial of former White House aide Scooter Libby had much more sensitive information than he does.
There is no united front. The journalists will not testify against their ethics. And it's kind of ridiculous to expect some young independent journalist to toe that line for the entire profession.
Now that he's out of prison, Wolf has found himself at the center of a heated debate.
Half the camp feels that I'm, you know, somehow this valiant fighter for the rights of the First Amendment, and I think I did hold that course pretty strongly. But then the other half feels that because I'm not objective, I'm not a journalist.
Wolf does consider himself a journalist.
I don't think that objectivity is realistic. I think objectivity was simply a backlash against so-called yellow journalism. And the real problem with yellow journalism was not that it had a view, a thesis, if you will, that it was trying to prove. The problem was that it didn't disclaim that it wasn't objective.
Wolf's work has focused on documenting and promoting the anarchist movement. Other journalists have argued he can't support a cause and be a journalist at the same time.
And if that is your thesis, then you yourself have just engaged in activism. And that's fine. That's part of journalism. But then you can't say that you can't be a journalist and an activist.
Now, Wolf is calling for a federal shield law that would give journalists the same privilege as doctors, priests, and other professionals who promise confidentiality to their clients. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Dale Jacquette. He's a professor of philosophy from Pennsylvania State University, and he's author of many things, but including the very recent Journalistic Ethics, Moral Responsibility in the Media. Dale, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Dale, our understanding of the rights and wrongs of journalism, I mean, questions like should journalists have shield laws so they don't have to testify before grand juries like the rest of us, these naturally raise the question, what is and what should be the role of journalists in our society? Can you give us a quick overview of the issues there?
Well, here's my formulation for that. I like to say that journalists are our eyes and ears and provide information for us in areas where we can't do so ourselves. So the way I like to think about the responsibility of journalism is that journalists are obligated to provide relevant truth-telling in the public interest.
So my eyes and ears, though, I mean, there are certain moral things you don't do with your eyes and ears. You don't window peep. You don't listen on other people's conversations. Journalists felt compelled to disclose this embarrassing conversation that some Hollywood star had with his daughter. Is that really part of their duty to the public?
No, I don't think so. I think there is a legitimate role for entertainment value in the news because it serves to unite a community and it serves to put us in touch with the lives of other persons to a limited extent. But I think in some instances, journalists do go too far.
I want to go back to the truth. Relevant truth telling, or something like that.
In the public interest.
In the public interest. That sounds pretty good, but I think we really need to dig into that a little bit more because.
Good.
Here's how some journalists seem to think you go about truth telling. You get somebody who claims something, you know, taxes ought to be raised or something. Taxes are too high. Or too low. Taxes are too low. You get somebody else who says, well, taxes are just right. Maybe you get somebody else who says taxes, and you just put that all out there. Now, and you let the public decide who to believe. How has the journalist told the truth there? The journalist has just provided a platform for argument and no independent evaluation of those arguments.
Yes, that's right. And in a certain sense, that's one of their legitimate roles, too, to at least make the public aware of the issues so that the public can decide for themselves. But if you want to defend that sort of journalistic practice on the grounds that they are, in fact, providing factual content in the news, one way to do so would be to say that, after all, they are reporting on the fact that certain persons hold those views. And if those persons are persons in authority, then that is itself newsworthy.
Well, if you combine that... journalists are not allowed to knowingly tell untruths. They're not protected from libel if they knowingly repeat untruths. But
exactly.
If somebody said something to them, then they have a right to repeat that. But if they also have a right to protect that person's identity, don't those two things together, that they can't be held guilty of libel if they're reporting what some authority believes, and then they don't even have to tell you who the authority is, don't they have license to libel in that case?
Yeah, that's a different case, isn't it, where they, for some reason or other, aren't revealing the source of their information. But in those instances, too, I mean, I think the proper journalistic practice, and this seems to be well established among journalists, is simply to state that for one reason or another, their source has preferred to remain anonymous.
This is good. This is good. But I still think we're kind of skimming the surface. Look, the preamble of the Society of Professional Journalists, the Code of Ethics, says something about public enlightenment is the forerunner of justice and the foundation of democracy. And then it says the duty of the journalist is to further those ends by seeking truth and then providing complete and accurate coverage of all issues or something like that.
Yes. Now,
I still want to know about this truth seeking. So we take the run up to the War of Iraq.
Yes.
Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein, somebody says, doesn't have those weapons. The journalist, I just want to know what his obligation is or her obligation is beyond just reporting that some people believe this and some people believe that. That's not truth-seeking. That's just, you know, reporting who says what.
Well, that's right.
Where's the truth-seeking obligation?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I think that if journalists limited themselves only to reporting what other persons said, if they didn't do investigative reporting and try to dig down and find out what the real facts are, then they wouldn't be properly fulfilling their true obligation as journalists.
Now, let me ask you a question. In our Constitution says freedom of the press shall not be abridged. So that we have an official recognition of a class of people there, the Fourth Estate or whatever it is.
Quite
now,
right.
With bloggers on the Internet, like the young man that was interviewed by our roving philosophical reporter, he's an independent journalist. I guess I could be an independent journalist. I could start a blog called John Perry's News. Does that mean anybody that has an Internet account is now going to be able to claim that they are protected by, say, California's shield law and shouldn't talk to grand juries? What is a journalist?
Yes. Well, a journalist is someone who does exactly what you've described. They're someone who tries to find out the facts and report them to an interested public. Whether anyone whatsoever can do that, well, I'm not sure. You can try, and you can see whether you'll find an audience. You can see whether you'll get any recognition or attention from the official news outlets, and you may not succeed. On the other hand, you might succeed outrageously, and you might do a better job than many people who are recognized as professional
journalists. What's an official news outlet? You mean one owned by a corporation? You have
to be
incorporated or something?
Well, you know, that might be the truth of the matter. That might be one of the facts of life. There are reasons why certain kinds of organizations have gained that sort of respect. One of the difficulties is that, at least traditionally, now prior to the advent of blog reporting, but traditionally, at least, it takes a lot of money to produce and report the news.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is ethics in journalism. Our guest is Dale Jacquette from Penn State University.
You can join in by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. What's your pet example of journalistic malfeasance? Do you think anybody can be a journalist just by having a blog on the Internet? Our number, 1-800-525-9917.
We'll take more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
We're talking about the news, specifically ethics in journalism. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. What sort of ethics should guide today's journalist? Is there a line between journalism and advocacy that shouldn't be crossed? Tell us what you think.
The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Our guest is Dale Yuckett from Penn State University.
Dale, let's dig into some cases. I know your book employs the method of case studies, and here's a case that puzzles me a lot is, you know, all these journalists in the Valerie Plame trial, they're all not wanting to testify, right, because of some principle, I don't know. I mean, but it seems to me the pursuit of justice required them to testify. I mean, what was on the journalist's side? I don't really get their arguments, to tell you the truth.
Well, I think part of it is that they want to be able to protect their confidential sources. It's essential to their being able to be effective in gathering the news that on occasion persons who don't want to be identified come forward with news information for them. And if that breaks down, then they're not able to continue to do it.
Yeah, that's what they say. But suppose that their confidential sources, they promise anonymity to these confidential sources. These confidential sources use that anonymity for their own purposes. They lie, they frame issues in a way that's detrimental to the pursuit of truth. I mean, what's the advantage to the public, whom journalists are supposed to serve, to allowing journalists to keep secrets for people who are just spinning and lying and manipulating?
Yes. Well, there may not be. I mean, it might turn out that in the long run, some sort of regulation of and some sort of judicial practices are going to have to evolve in order to govern the exact use of confidential sources. But journalists seem to be willing to argue on principle, and the fellow Wolf that you had quoted earlier in the program is a perfect example of this. He had his own reasons. He was arguing himself that he wasn't really protecting any particularly valuable information with the materials that were cut out, but still he felt the need to do so. I mean, I guess journalists feel that it's essential to their practice that they be able to rely on that sort of anonymity from their sources.
Now, my understanding, and this is what Wolf said, is that California and a number of other states do have a shield law, and he feels that if it had been a state court, he would have been exempt.
That's correct.
But the federal government hasn't seen, either in Congress to enact such a law or in the courts, to find that freedom of the press requires such a law. So, I mean, what's the thinking there? Does freedom of the press mean freedom to publish whatever you want, but not necessarily to live in a world where life is made easy for journalists? Or,
Dale,
or does it go further than that?
Dale, before you answer that question, I'm going to put the same question to our listeners. What do you think?
Okay.
Does freedom of the press, listeners, mean that anything goes, that the reporters should be able to report and say whatever they want, protect their confidential sources, no matter the social cost? Give us a call, 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. So, Dale, what do you think?
Well, you asked me to explain the reasoning of federal government officials, and I'm not particularly good at doing that for a variety of reasons. But I think there should be a federal shield law, and I think there should be a public debate about what the limits of responsible reliance of journalists on confidential sources are and what they should be.
Why do you think that? You're a philosopher king. Why do you think that?
Well, I think it because it serves the interests of a free society to have that sort of unrestricted flow of information. Now, quite right, some of what passes for information might not be particularly useful, and it might not always be in the social for the social good. That's why I think there needs to be some sort of public discussion about these matters, and there needs to be some sort of federal framework for these kinds of things. It's outrageous that there should be protections at the state level, but not at the federal.
Now, one of our listeners has just sent us an email about his favorite example of journalistic malfeasance that I think is right on this point. On Tuesday, April 24th, Fox's Fox and Friends repeatedly broadcast a fake news story about a middle school in Lewiston, Maine. Administrators at the school were investigating what they believed to be a hate crime against Muslim students, but Fox repeatedly misreported that the school was launching a major campaign against nothing more than the presence of Ham on school premises, assuring its viewers that we're not making this up, but they were making it up. So, I mean, what happens in a case like that? Does the school, does the public have any recourse against people who just say false things on cable news?
Well, shame on them for doing so in the first place. But what recourse one has, of course, is to vote with one's feet and stop listening and stop subscribing to that news source, and to write in and complain and raise a ballyhoo about the abuses of journalistic privilege.
Well, that's well enough. Let's let the marketplace regulate this stuff, you know. But you know, part of the problem is that the market. I hate to say this. I don't want to insult the market up. It's made of us, right? And
yes,
sometimes
yes.
We love this. I mean, why is there so much infotainment on parading as news? Why is there so much one-sided coverage? Like the why does the Fox News Corporation get away with being such a one-sided? I hate to say that, but it's true. One-sided thing. Well, because we, the public, you know, there's a sucker born every minute. So I'm not sure the market, if we want journalism to be instrumental to the pursuit of truth, I'm not sure that the mere market is going to give us a journalistic set of corporations whose main interest is the pursuit of truth. Do you think otherwise?
Well, no. I mean, I think that there needs to be some sort of balance between market forces on the one hand, which serve a valuable role in a free society for regulating these kinds of things. But the trouble is that the market forces sometimes bring about a balance in these matters, but they often take a long time, and a lot of damage can be done in the interim. So I think that, first of all, journalists have to be properly trained and educated in these matters. I think the public needs to be aware of what is happening when they're observing the news, and they need to get more proactive about letting their opinions know about what counts as genuine news for them. And I think in some instances there needs to be some regulation as well.
Bob in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bob. What's your comment or question? You there, Bob? I don't seem to have Bob, so I'll put another question to you. Look, take. You know, I'm not quite. I want to know your philosophical vision, as it were, Dale, of the of the ideal journalistic thing. Because you said, yeah, you think there should be a federal shield law, but you think there ought to be limits to it. It sounded like, right? Because you said sometimes that information is misinformation. So, what's your view? If I gave you dictatorial powers, how would you organize this thing?
Yes. Well, ideally, of course, journalists would simply regulate themselves. They would have the right sort of notion about what it is to report the truth in a responsible way, and they would just do it. Since, realistically speaking, that's not the case, the question is, well, what are the best stopgap measures we can offer to bring ourselves closer to the ideal and to alleviate some of the problems that arise in the meantime? And again, I think one of the main things to do is to educate journalists to make this clear. I think that there ought to be also some sort of legislation. There ought to be some enforcement of the most egregious violations of journalistic privilege as well. The case you cited from Fox Network is a bad and I hope not too typical case, but in a way. With instantaneous broadcasting of information across electronic media, that sort of thing is almost impossible absolutely to prevent. So in one, there are preventative measures that one can take, namely by educating persons. And on the other hand, the question becomes, once it's done, what we can do about it. And there I recommend, a combination of people reacting, the market force responding to it, and also perhaps some sort of penalties attached.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about ethics and journalism with our guest, Dale Jacquette. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. We're eager to have you add your voice to this conversation.
Dale, let me ask you a partly factual, partly philosophical question about something you mentioned. That's the idea of self-regulation. Now, the district attorney who prosecuted these kids in Duke with apparently not much of a case was censured by the State Bar Association, I believe. Bill Clinton was prevented from practicing law in his home state for some amount of time. So bar associations are able to censure their members. Is there anything like that in journalism, and should there be? I mean, wouldn't that be preferable to government regulation, but at least we'd have something? Somebody like Nancy Grace could be said, you know, her fellows could say, hey, you went too far in this case.
Yes. I think to a certain extent that kind of thing does happen. And, of course, the worst examples of these sorts of things, Jason Blair and Stephen Glass at the New Republic, Jason Blair at the New York Times, those cases, those persons do wind up being fired. And I suppose for lesser offenses, people do wind up being censored. There are probably all kinds of internal regulation of these offenses. And to whatever extent the industry can self-regulate itself without having external censorship, I'm all in favor of that.
But, you know, but firing an employee is different from the news organization itself being subject to censure because you think the acts of the employees are the act of the corporation itself. But I think a deep part of the problem is, and tell me if you think I'm right or wrong about this, I think the deep part of the problem with journalism today is that so much of it is in the hands of huge corporations who are just, in the end, corporations. And they are no more interested in shaking up the structures of power and speaking truth to power than any other corporation is, right? Than Exxon or whatever. So it's a really odd thing. We have these huge corporate entities.
Well, corporations are a big problem in journalism, but, I mean, that's part of a really big problem. I heard on the radio the other day that Monsanto has now patented the soybean. So
Right. But I'm just saying that the ethical complexity of journalism is made more complicated, and I wonder if you agree or disagree, Dale.
Oh, I do agree. I do agree, and there are conflicts with the profit motive that run through journalism, from the reporter on the street all the way up to the editorial boards and the corporations that produce and market the news. So that's a problem to be sure. One thing, of course, that happens is that some networks and some news outlets find ways of censoring other news outlets. So if you've got a pattern of deliberate abuse on the part of the corporation itself and not just individual rogue reporters, then there's often a way in which those kinds of abuses can at least be made public, and these persons can be, in some instances, I suppose, held responsible for what they do.
1-800-525-9917. We've been bashing journalists a little bit, but callers, here's a question for you. When have you seen observed a journalist get it right, make the correct ethical decision? Give us a call and tell us what you think. 1-800-525-9917.
Dale, as I look back over my long life, some of the most outstanding journalists have been people like I.F. Stone, who weren't part of major corporations. He had his own little newsletter. Our younger listeners may not remember during the Vietnam War. He published a lot of stuff that was very important. So you'd think the Internet really could be a grounds for optimism, that although on the one hand our TV and cable news is more and more and under the grip of larger and larger corporations, there is this countervailing force now, the blogosphere. Are you hopeful about that?
I am. I think it's got its risks, too, but I'm hopeful about it. In answer to your question before, I said that anyone who takes it upon his or herself to report on the news and do so in a responsible fashion is, in fact, a journalist. There's no reason why information transmitted over blogs can't be just as valuable to the public as information received over more conventional sources.
Ed in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ed. Are you there? Ed? We seem to be having technical difficulties. We keep losing our callers. Ed, are you there? Well, he's not there, so we're going to keep trying to call callers, and we'll try to get this fixed. So let me ask you a question about this corporate thing one last time. The profit mode. It seems to me that here's something that has happened to a lot of journalists. When I was young, I viewed journalists as truth-seeking speakers of truth to power. Because I grew up during the time when the Vietnam War was being unraveled because of reporting, and a few years later, a corrupt and arrogant president was brought down by journalists. You know, so I viewed them as truth seekers fundamentally at bottom. Now I think a lot of them are kind of corporate careerists. Right, they're in these huge corporations. They're trying to make a career for themselves. They want these insider tips to give them the career-making story, but they have to tell the story in terms that the insider will let be told. What do you think about that? Is that corrupting journalism as much as I think, or have I just grown old and cynical?
Well, I agree with you. I agree that my idealistic sense of news reporting, it was shaped pretty much by that same sort of era. And I still think that the watchdog function that news reporting serves is valuable. I don't see any reason why that need be an obstacle to anyone making a career in journalism. And in fact, it seems to me that the best path to the recognition of real journalistic talent is still that kind of exposé. So I don't see, even with the corporate pressure that a lot of news reporters might be under, I think that in part because of the internet and in part because of the wide variety of different sorts of journalistic outlets in a free society, that there still remains the potential always for that kind of best sort of journalism that helps to serve the social good in a really profound kind of way.
Ede in Berkeley is back on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ede. Are you there now? Do we have Ede? I don't know. We're having great trouble with callers today. So
the powers that be are unhappy with our probing questioning of journalistic ethics. So I know that what Ede wanted to ask is, how can people protect themselves from media people who have an agenda? And her examples were Thomas Friedman and Judy Miller. I guess my answer would be that in Thomas Friedman's case, I'm a fairly regular reader of him. He usually makes his agenda fairly clear, even when he's wrongheaded, like the run-up to the Iraq War, in my opinion, or when he's right-headed, as his more recent work on environmentalism and global economy. Judith Miller, I'm not so sure about that. What do you think, Dale?
Well, I'm a big fan of Thomas Friedman myself, and one of the things I've tried to do in my book on journalistic ethics is not offer a set of do's and don'ts for journalists, but really to portray journalism as a kind of a noble profession, one that can serve the public interest in all kinds of important ways. And part of what I see as the essential task, and one of the main requirements of journalistic ethics, is to draw a very clear line, just as you've suggested, between, on the one hand, reporting the facts in the public interest and editorializing on the other. So I think that someone who has an agenda has, in fact, a journalistic moral responsibility to make it clear, so that when they're offering their opinion, they are distinguishing that very, very clearly from when they are reporting the facts as to their best understanding.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing ethics in journalism with Dale Jacquette from Penn State University. We're having some difficulty with our phone lines, so we haven't been able to get any callers through, but you can still send us emails at comments@philosophytalk.org. We'll get to your emails, calls we can't handle right now, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Today's episode of Philosophy Talk is brought to you by The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels.
Available at your local bookstore. It worked for Stalin. It might work for you, too. Says she wants me to meet her at the station. Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news? Ain't that news? Ain't that good news?
Ethics in Journalism. That's our topic today on Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my colleague John Perry. I was going to say give us a call, but don't give us a call since the phone lines aren't working. Send us some email, comments@philosophytalk.org. We want to know what you think about this fraught topic.
We've got some email here, which I'll share with Ken and our guest, Dale Jacquette from Penn State University. This is from Andy, and he makes a very good point. Journalism differs, or should differ, from blogging in that a certain set of questions need to be addressed: who, where, what, and so forth. And blogging has no such formal structure. But a good blog should contain hyperlinks to use as references and sources the blogger is commenting on. A person commenting on a blog should be recognized as someone offering information which has to be verified, or opinion which is just that, opinion. In other words, standards for blogging need to emerge as blogging becomes part of journalism. Good point, Andy.
What do you think, Adele?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's true that there are all kinds of blogs, and it's sort of the Wild West out there right now with respect to the kinds of information that's available on the Internet. Once again, it's a kind of buyer beware situation. You can read a variety of different things on the Internet. There should be some self-restraint exercise. There should be some standards emerging. But I think that the potential for the medium is every bit as good as any other conventional source of news information.
I think it's actually, my own view is that the potential is that it's superior because buyer beware. We think when we hear something from CNN or the New York Times or something, we don't have to have as much buyer beware. But I'm not so convinced of that anymore. I mean, there might have been a brief period, but I'm not even sure. I think we've got to be very wary. And here's why I think we have to be very wary. Because these folks think of themselves not as so much apart from the entrenched power structures and reporting on them and explaining them, but deeply part of the entrenched power structures. Take the Iraq War. I think the corporate media at large failed America utterly there, and I think it's partly because of their own perceived relationship to these entrenched power structures. What do you think? Am I right? Am I wrong? Am I exaggerating? Not exaggerating?
I agree. I agree 100%. And I think that part of the problem also is, and some commentators on the media, like Neil Postman in his book Amusing Ourselves to Death, has made an excellent point in this regard. He observes that there are only about four outlets of news investigation, and that most of the other news sources that you're likely to tap into merely repeat things and reword things that they've gotten from these central sources. So Reuters and Associated Press and a few other places, most of them associated with newspapers rather than electronic media, are primarily responsible for most of the news that we are actually exposed to.
You know, there was a very good program on PBS with Bill Moyers, at least I thought it was very good. And he made the point that Knight Ridder actually did a significantly better job of examining the information about weapons of mass destruction and other things that came out of the government on the run-up to Iraq, but that they're pretty much ignored because they don't have a Washington outlet. So in part, we've got a problem with journalism. In part, we just have journalism suffering from a problem of this kind of navel-gazing of our Washington elites, where they really don't pay any attention to other sources of information, in my humble opinion.
That's exactly right, and one wonders what one can do about it. I mean, you can't wave a wand and suddenly make journalists do their job in a different way. It has to come about because there's market pressure for them to do so, and it's not until the public demands better news, demands better quality news, and more in-depth backgrounding in stories and the sort of information that we really need to be effective decision makers that we can expect anything like that to come about.
Well, maybe we need a more radical solution, like moving the Senate to Denver and the House to San Francisco. There's no reason to have it all in Washington, D.C. in this day and age. But that's slightly off topic, so I'll just leave it at that.
It's related because there's concentrated powers. But, you know, this is, again, one of the reasons I have hope. I agree, though, the blogosphere is unruly and unregulated and Wild West, and you never know what you're going to get. But out of that unruly Wild West thing, unless the corporations come in and dominate it in the way that corporations dominate most things, there may be something new emerging out of that, right? There may be like the clarion call of the outside voice, you know, speaking truth to power and trying to explain people in a way that doesn't borrow the terms of explanation from the entrenched groups.
Yes. I've got very ambivalent feelings about all of this corporate structure myself. I mean, on the one hand, most of the good things and most of the aspects of the quality of our life come directly or indirectly from corporations. On the other hand, they can't simply have a free hand in doing what they want to do because we know the kinds of things that they'll do in those circumstances. So I think, as in all areas in a free society, there has to be something like a system of checks and balances, not only within the government, but on all public organizations that in one way or another affect our lives.
We've got an email from a former NPR reporter, Paul in San Francisco. He says, Ken, John, and Dale, as a former NPR affiliate reporter, I was struck by the fact that many professional journalists simply are not very well educated. I personally witnessed reporters from major syndicates literally make up words and put them in someone's mouth if they didn't seem to understand the actual quote. Regressive taxation became oppressive taxation. Obstreperous complaint became rancorous complaint, etc. Don't journalists have a professional obligation to be well educated? Isn't there a systematic bias caused simply by the lack of schooling for reporters? Thanks, Paul. What do you think, Dale?
Well, I think that's in large part true. I think they do indeed have an obligation not only to be well educated simply in terms of the craft of journalism, but also they need to be well morally educated. They need to understand the sort of standards to which they ought to be held, and there ought to be plenty of opportunity for them through role-playing and other kinds of educational devices for them to come to understand exactly what the implications of journalistic malfeasance can be.
Yeah, we've got another email here from Steve, and he says, if five corporations control most of the news outlets in the country, and if these corporations exercise control of their media in their interest, can't we connect the dots and cancel corporate control of the media? And he says, wouldn't return to the fairness doctrine be an effective vehicle? Just let me put 2 cents in there. We've got this principle that's in our Constitution, freedom of the press. And I'm sure that what the constitutional people had in mind is some guy like Ben Franklin that puts out, he owns a press, an actual press, and he does the reporting and puts it out. How does freedom of the press, as originally envisaged, translate in freedom of large corporations to do what they want with the media outlets that they control? I'm really torn. On the one hand, I don't like the government involved in anything; they mess it up. On the other hand, I don't like to have I like to watch TV, and I'd like to have the feeling that somebody on there besides PBS was really trying to put out the truth.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the easy solution to those problems. As I say, we can't wave a wand and suddenly make journalists do what we'd like them to do. The best we can do is complain, stand up for the kinds of journalistic practice that we'd like to see done, and insist on it. But one wonders in a pluralistic democracy like ours, whether that message is actually going to get through, and whether there are ultimately enough people who are demanding that kind of thing.
Yeah. See, I worry that what the people demand isn't... So journalism is supposed to be an instrument of democracy, of truth-seeking and all that. And there's two different models you could have. I heard Cokie Roberts say her job as a journalist is to explain the political class and their actions to the body politic. That's what she does. Explain those guys to us, right? I think she must have got that from Walter Lippmann or something like that, because that was kind of his view. Mm-hmm. And then another view is kind of Dewey-inspired view. You know, journalists are one interlocutor in the body politic among others, and they should be always arguing and testing arguments. So, and they have independent sources of information and evidence, and so they're not just trying to explain; they're trying to alter and change. And I think that latter thing, that Dewey thing, is much nicer. But we're a long way from that, it seems to me.
Yes. I agree. I agree. And here's an analogy that I like to sometimes make. If you simply allow persons to have what they want from professionals in a variety of fields, then, for example, your physician might be called upon to give you, let's say, exciting drugs instead of giving you the sort of treatments that you actually need. And that's not responsible. And similarly, but in the journalistic field, it seems as though what journalists provide us as professionals is just whatever we want, which is a large dose of entertainment, a small dose of facts, and an even smaller dose of backgrounding information that will help us to interpret and understand those facts. So, again, what's the solution? Well, there are professional ethics for medical practitioners. There are and ought to be professional standards for journalists as well. Journalists need to be educated in this. News desks and news offices need to set a high standard, and they need to encourage this kind of practice among their journalistic reporters. If that's not done, then I think the situation cannot improve. But I think that having the government interfere and try to impose a set of standards on journalists in that sort of way, I think that's not only hopeless but dangerous as well.
Well, Dale, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. Love the Steely Dan.
Our guest has been Dale Jacquette, professor of philosophy from Pennsylvania State University, author of Journalistic Ethics, Moral Responsibility in the Media.
We also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to, which today means all the callers, because our phone lines let us down, and we didn't get to all of our emails, so thanks for sending it to us.
Yeah, the email kind of stepped into the breach a little bit at the last minute there. So, John, where's your thoughts today? I mean, what do you...
Well, as the program commenced, my initial skepticism about whether it's a good thing that every blogger can claim to be a journalist gave way to thinking maybe that's the best hope. I mean, as I think over the journalists that I think have really been terrific, they're a mixed bunch. Seymour Hersh, pretty independent. David Halberstam, originally writing for the New York Times, the same group that gave us Judith Miller. Woodward and Bernstein, writing for the Washington Post, and yet when they were young Turks and didn't have all that inside information. So I think journalists ought to challenge the elite, and that means both government and corporations. But our journalists either work for corporations or PBS, in which case Congress controls their budget. So I don't know. I'm pretty depressed.
I am too. I think, you know, I think the part of the problem is that journalists, especially sort of the Washington Press Corps, the national media, as it were, are part of the elite. Right, they are an entrenched part of the elite, and they think their jobs, they really do think their jobs, is to let the competing elites do battle on the platforms they provide. So you get a Republican who says P, you get a Democrat who says something other than P. The journalist is kind of the neutral referee in some sense of, you know, but that's about it. Right. Whether we ought to pee or we ought to do this one or that one, that's not for the journalist to decide, because that would be to abandon neutrality. But if it stops there, you know, I just don't think it does much for us. That's my view anyway.
Well, you know, as I look over last week and think where on my television watching, did I really see things challenged? The answer comes down to two guys who have no chance in the Democratic primary. Gravel, who asks the question that nobody asks, why does America have all these nuclear weapons? And Dennis Kucinich, who asks all kinds of questions. And I'm not being partisan here. I'm sure that the ones with no chance in the Republican side will be the ones who make the most interesting questions, too. Journalists aren't really always doing the job.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, this conversation continues. I've already gotten it started on our blog, Philosophy Talk, the blog, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For a final word on ethics and journalism, we turn to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, reporters are dropping like flies under allegations of plagiarism, fabrication, and outright fraud. More and more readers are turning to that bastion of truth and integrity, the blogosphere, for their nonfiction needs. In fact, the entire nonfiction genre seems to be in jeopardy. Prize-winning biographers like Doris Kearns Goodwin and Stephen Ambrose have reeled under accusations of plagiarism. The memoir, the current staple of bestseller lists, is also reeling. There was the Navajo memoirist Nas Dish, who turned out to be a white writer of gay erotica. There was a Holocaust memoirist, Benjamin Wilkomirski, who turned out to be a Swiss Protestant. Augustine Burroughs, author of Running with Scissors, was accused in Vanity Fair of making up incidents whole cloth. James Frye, in his memoir of addiction, A Million Little Pieces, had to admit that some of the bad events in his book never happened. Many readers were disappointed to discover that J.T. Leroy was not actually a cross-dressing, transgendered former boy prostitute, but a woman. What a letdown. A new scandal has materialized, but whether it has legs remains to be seen. Alex Hurd in The New Republic wrote an article called This American Lie, in which he fact-checked the works of David Sedaris and discovered that some of the events he describes as true weren't. Mr. Sedaris found many defenders in the media, typical as Peter Carlson in The Washington Post, who called the accusation truly ridiculous and suggested that Hurd also go after James Thurber, Mark Twain, and Bill Cosby. Jack Schaefer, who writes Pressbox for Slate.com, begged to differ. Quote, I expected him, Sedaris, to acknowledge that he had erred by making up stuff, but those days were behind him. I was wrong, unquote. Sedaris has freely admitted in many interviews cited by Hurd that he exaggerates for comic effect. I still stand by what I wrote, he told Newsday in March. What's this teapot tempest all about? Well, Sedaris's books are labeled nonfiction. As Mr. Hurd commented, it's the cover-up, not the crime. This is a hard thing for me to get worked up about, ethic-wise. If his music teacher was, in fact, not a midget, but merely a short man, well, okay, thanks for pointing that out. Thanks for ruining the joke. To my mind, these critics are like Ralph Nader at a barbecue. You're trying to enjoy your brat while he's telling you what's really in it. Besides, writers have a long history of mixing exaggeration and whoppers into their personal stories. Gene Shepard, Spalding Gray, Calvin Trillin, Garrison Keillor, Dave Barry, Irma Bombeck, Errol Flynn, Frank Harris, Rousseau, Casanova. Speaking personally, I don't mind a kidder, but I do hate a spinner. In any case, is nonfiction really the section of the store where you'll find David Sedaris' books? I suspect you'll find better luck in humor. The commentary you've just heard is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. I gotta go.
That was Ian Scholes, digging deep, digging fast. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Zoe Cornelli, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Thank you.